This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Michal Ledwith, and we're going to talk about his book, The Orb Project, and his new book. I'm not quite sure the name of that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about both of them, Michal, and tell us a little about you and your background and how you got to where you are today before we start.
Sure, Eva. Thank you so much. It's great to be on with you tonight. And yes, The Orb Project, the book, which was co-authored by Klaus Heinemann and myself, was published by Simon & Schuster and Beyond Words last November. Now, I'd been very interested in the phenomenon of orbs for 6 or 7 years past, and someone kindly said at the launch in New York that I had the largest collection of orb photographs in the world. But be that as it may, I have certainly 50 or 60,000 of them. And they asked me to put down, you know, in this book what I thought they were and what I had found out about the best ways to contact and understand what's going on here. So that's what we've tried to do in our book. And since then, I've brought out my own Orb DVD, which was published about a month or two ago, called Orbs, Clues to a More Exciting Universe, because I felt that it wasn't appropriate just to keep taking some of these, you know, admittedly remarkable orb pictures all the time and just build up a huge kind of family photograph album of spirit entities of one kind or another, that we should use them to tell us something about the nature of the universe, the nature of consciousness, the nature of ourselves, and how we program the world to give us what we desire. So, you know, I said to them that if you just keep taking orb pictures, which I've probably done more of than anyone, we'd be like those physicians, you know, sometime back in the 1800s when the microscope was discovered. They began to see chromosomes and all sorts of things in the blood for the first time under the microscope. But, you know, they didn't stop, you know, with the pictures. They went on to apply this to healing disease and promoting wellness. Likewise, I think orbs have an enormous amount to teach us about the structure of the universe, and I think especially about programming the subconscious mind and the quantum field, because that is, the quantum field is not programmed through the conscious mind, which is, I think, why so many self-help endeavors have not yielded very, very many results of anything. Mm-hmm. I'm talking in Glastonbury next week about that subject, so that's where I am right now, and that's where I got to this program.
What is your background?
Well, I was a Catholic priest for a very long time. I was a professor of theology, and eventually was president of the university, Maynooth University, outside of Dublin, for 10 years, so a 10-year term. And then I decided to move out here to the States after I retired, and I've been pursuing, you know, what I used to call years ago those four great questions that every one of us has to ask. Who am I? Where did I come from? What should I be doing while I'm here? And where the heck am I going?
I have to ask this question.
Sure.
Now that you came from the church, did the church not answer those questions for you?
Oh, no, I'm afraid not.
Religion,
you know,
not satisfy that?
No. My website, if you ran across it on the internet, is called hamburgeruniverse.com. And I was giving a talk probably 15 years ago to a big audience of people, and I was trying to illustrate the mindsets that keep us disempowered and disenfranchised, so much subject to disease, old age, and infirmity. And I was drawing this on the board, and I drew the earth in the middle, you know, decently flat, slightly elliptical, and above it I drew the arc of the heavens where God and the angels and the saints are waiting, and I had God with a telescope looking down on the world, scrutinizing everything we do and entering it into his laptop, because I assumed he had moved with the times like everyone else, and the laptop had replaced the Book of Life. And then underneath I had the arc of the underworld beneath the earth where Satan and his minions abide, and when I stood back, I said, my goodness, that looks like a hamburger. And I call this mindset that keeps us all imprisoned, mm-hmm, the hamburger universe.
I actually did read your website.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I did.
I'm preaching to the converted then, hopefully.
I try to interview like a deposition because that's my background litigation. were you into this? And I'm going to give you plenty of time to talk. I just have to know these questions. Were you into consciousness when you were an active priest?
Well, I was always interested, Eva, you know, in trying to find out the purpose of why we were here. And basically, you know, that image of the hamburger universe is the church's answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
We're put down here, you know, for a trial period by God, and we're scrutinized on our performance. And when we die, the tally is, you know, worked out. And depending on the plus or the minus side of the equation, I'm sent either up to heaven to sit on a cloud for all eternity, staring at God and playing a harp, or I'm sent down to hell to be punished. And, you know, this didn't tell me anything. It certainly wasn't a message of hope and message of cheer. It certainly wasn't a message of empowerment. What I used to ponder when I was a practicing theologian for so many years, I mean, I was professor, I was head of department, etc., dean of the faculty, what puzzled me was that Jesus had said, say in the Gospel of St. John, that, you know, if we did what he taught, that we would do all the wonders, that's the miracles, that he did, and greater indeed than these will you do. I mean, it's in John chapter 14, anyone wants to look it up. And I was looking around, you know, at Christianity. I remember I was speaking in Cape Town about, I think it was in the year 2000 or the close of 99, at a great conference called the Parliament for a Conference of World Religions. And I discovered to my horror, and I'm not easily horrified in this sphere anyway, that there are now over 20,000 Christian denominations, churches, and congregations on the face of the earth. And they all have a different take on the message of Jesus, and some of them claim to be the only true version of it. But in all of those, I was saying, where are these words of Jesus, you know, being verified today? Where are they doing all the wonders that he did? You know, almost nowhere. We hear of an occasional, what we call in our ignorance, a miracle now and again, and everyone just bows down and worships more, deepening the enslavement in which we all are. But this was spoken of as if it was our birthright, and certainly it wasn't happening. So I found that was extremely dissatisfying for me, and I knew also, of course, from my contacts with so many thinking people, I mean, hundreds upon hundreds of them that I personally knew, that they found the whole scenario really didn't add up, that there's something had got lost out of it. And I produced a DVD 2 years ago, which is nearly 4 hours long, called How Jesus Became a Christ, because the first thing that I realized in all of this was that the message of Jesus had got turned on its head, and the idea that he just came here to suffer and die for our sins and then rise from the dead on the third day, etc., all just didn't add up. You know, by coincidence, on last Tuesday, I had the opportunity to spend almost the entire day with the makers of that new movie, Bloodline. Maybe you've heard of it. It's about the discoveries in the region of Rennes-le-Château in France of this tomb that might contain the bodies of Mary Magdalene and perhaps some of the family of Jesus. So it revived a lot of what I'd been thinking about, that really the message of Jesus, nothing to do with that sort of stuff at all, that what he came into this world to do was to empower us all. I mean, if someone can raise the dead, walk on water, heal the sick, and produce food out of thin air, obviously in touch with God, that's a good enough working definition of divinity for me, at least. And the thing is, he came to teach us to do that. Now, what it was turned into was he came to suffer and die for our sins, to appease the vengeance of a savage God against us. And, you know, that doesn't add up, because basically that's an atheistic position. If you think God is so fickle, vindictive, secure, psychotic and neurotic that he would demand the tortured death of his only innocent son, well, what would that say about such a God? There is no such God. God is not of that kind at all. And when people, you know, think that this is the be-all and the end-all about Jesus, they're on the wrong track. This is not why he came here, and it's not why we're here either.
I'll tell you what I think. I think I want to have you back and do a whole show on just all of that.
I would love to. I can send you on some of the material if you want it.
I do. I mean, because I have a lot of questions, but I know if we get into this,
sure,
we won't talk about your orbs.
That's why I spent 5 hours with the Bloodline movie makers on Tuesday last.
I mean, I could ask a million questions going down that line, but I don't want to skip over your orbs because that's what I promised you I would do tonight.
Okay.
My first question is going to be, what is God to you, away from a religion, as far as it relates to consciousness and the orbs? Is it an energy? And if so, does it reside, is the field that energy? Or does it deep down beneath the field, maybe, the irreducible unit?
Well, the way I think of God, you know, most of us think of God as some variant or form of a human being. God is basically a human being enlarged.
And without a body or with the body?
Well, you know, usually it's unspecified, but people think of God as up there, you know, or down there. That's why I always worry about the Australians, you know, when they're looking up to God. I don't know where they're looking. Anyway, but we think of God as up there, that he's intimately involved like a human being would be, but maybe more, you know, tolerant, you know, more vast than that. But basically, that God is someone up there who acts like a human being would react. That basically, you know, is the problem, because this is not what God is. If you regard what we understand about the physical universe, if we look at the electromagnetic spectrum, for instance, which is the whole panorama of the created universe, we're down here in the Hertzian field. Above us is infrared, where most of those orbs are captured. Mm-hmm. Above that again is the light. Above that again is the ultraviolet spectrum, and so on. That's the panoply of creation. And my own teacher, Ramtha, from whom I first heard about orbs 6 or 7 years ago and inspired a lot of my research on this subject, you know, reckons that the universe is like a giant triad or a cone with these 7 layers to it, which is reminiscent of course, Buddhist and Hindu theories from very ancient times. And the source of that, the zero-point field, as people like Laszlo and company in the past decade would talk about it, is what God is. It's a pulsating personal energy that pervades all things that exist.
Mm-hmm.
So, that, in other words, if you're thinking again of the words of Jesus about that, or of St. Paul, where he said that we live, move, and have our being in God, this is a perfect way to express it. But if you think of God as just an enlarged human being, obviously God is always someone outside of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, God is invariably masculine in all of the patriarchal religions of the West that we have come to know. And we're basically dealing with a human being enlarged. So if we think of God as this energy that pervades everything, a personal pervasive energy that's conscious and absolutely supports all that exists, I think we have a much better understanding of what God is and how it relates.
Mm-hmm.
I think so many atheists and agnostics have thrown out belief in God, and with it they've thrown out, unfortunately, the hope for the eternal that rests in the heart of every man and woman that's ever walked on this earth. They've thrown that out with it because they reject the images of God, which are so mawkish and sentimental as they are provided by, you know, the religions, and they say that, you know, these couldn't be real, but then they don't search for what could be real and what could be acceptable and what could empower us. Because I think a rule of thumb, Eva, is if you find some system of thought or belief that results in our disempowerment or our enslavement or our bringing down, you know, into guilt or into suffering or to fear, if you have some system of thought that does that in however subtle a way, you are really on the wrong trail there.
Yes, I agree. We know a lot of people that, and I don't mean to get off on this topic again, but I can't help it. A lot of people that, the Christians or whoever it is, the fundamental religions, when they do see someone that has a power such as Jesus did, they think they're heretics or
absolutely
crazy.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to believe it, even though it's like, I'm a medical intuitive. And I have a really high accuracy rate, but people, it just came one day a few years ago. So when it came, my family members, rather than thinking that it was a gift of God, thought that I'd gone off the edge and had gone crazy. You know, but it came from somewhere. But they chose to think that it came from the devil.
Well, that's always the immediate reaction, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, if anyone, I remember one time, I don't know if you ever heard of James Galway. He's an Irish flute player from Belfast, extraordinarily gifted man. And he was giving a concert in Philadelphia. And someone said to me afterwards, we were actually meeting him in the reception, and they said he has a devilish talent. And I said, why not say a divine talent? Or
exactly.
Does all talent come from the demons? Does all miracle working come from the demons? Are you suspected of being in league with the devil if you show any ability that's out of the normal?
That's right.
And that, unfortunately, is the case. All power is with the devil and none is with God.
That's right. So tell me a little bit about the orbs. I haven't gotten to read your new work, so I only have the Orb Project. So I want to know, what does it tell you about consciousness? I want to know what proof that you have. I want to know about how they shape to the camera lens. I want to know what's out there, that what kind of factual information can you contribute that gives us a little more information about consciousness and intention and physical reality and creativity.
Okay. Well, I was approached by Simon & Schuster and Beyond Words to do this book, you know, about, I suppose it was about 2 years ago now. I put the book together, and Klaus Heinemann came in with me. He's a physicist who has worked with NASA and a very, very accomplished man in his own right. But I was fascinated by these apparently spherical-shaped beings that are showing up more and more in photography these days. You know, some people are puzzled. Some people feel it's a camera fault when they get these spherical objects in their pictures. Now, I of course, realized when this was happening that even though I have orb pictures taken on film cameras from 20, 30 years ago, with the advent of the point-and-shoot digital camera in the past 10 years or so, the number of times orbs show up in the picture is much, much greater. And the reason is because, for reasons we don't need to go into today, orbs are most easily captured in the high band of infrared radiation, which is just below what you and I can see with the naked eye. So the digital camera, being sensitive to that high infrared band, is much more suitable for picking up orbs than a film camera is. But the film camera will do it as well. Now, I've also discovered, as I outlined in the book, that orbs are not seen by reflected light. You know, if I take a family group, a wedding or a 4th of July party or whatever, mm-hmm. I flash my camera and the light bounces off the people and the food and the tables, the chairs, the trees, etc. And that's recorded on the camera plate. Now, if there's an orb or two or 100 in those pictures, that's not how the orb is registered. At least this is my theory. What happens is that the light photons from the camera flash strike the orb. They turn into electrons immediately on striking the orb.
Now, stop right there for a second.
Okay.
What is the importance of that? From what I understand, electrons is really the basis of mass. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, so we're talking about the components of the atom here.
So the fact that they turn into electrons immediately, what is that telling my listeners, that they're
Well, what
here,
happens,
right?
It's not telling your listeners anything right now till I just finish my little discourse here, but when they turn into electrons, it now adds to the number of electrons that are already in the orb. It's like blowing up a balloon, Eva.
Okay.
The electrons, the content of the electrons is swelled up and increased. When the camera flash stops, which is only a thousandth of a second, the impetus from the flash obviously has now ceased, and the orb will shrink back to close to its original size. It stays slightly larger. Now, the surplus electrons that came in from the flash, there's no room for them anymore in the orb, so they're spit out, and they become light photons again and go back to the camera, and that is the light that photographed the orb. In other words, on the 4th of July party, there's two lights coming back to the camera. The people around the barbecue pit, they're reflected light, and the orbs are seen by this other process, which is known in physics as fluorescence. Now, the importance of that for the listeners is the fluoresced light coming from an object tells you what the object is made of. And what I discovered was that there are orbs of probably 6 levels above us, which you can detect from the frequency of the light that they fluoresce back from the camera. In other words, if I have a blue light orb, I know it's from the ultraviolet plane. If I have a gold orb, I know it's from the plane above that, the X-ray plane. If I have a red orb, I know it's from the infrared plane, just below visible light.
Okay.
So orbs are standing in all of these dimensions above us. But the basic fact here, Eva, this is not all cloud cuckoo land stuff, is that if we are living here now on the bottom plane of reality, the Hertzian plane, here, the solid ground, rocks, trees, mud, etc., we have to also be existing in the 6 planes above this, or we wouldn't exist at all. In other words, we can't hang in free space.
Right.
It's like garments in a closet. You know, the top level of the garment is hanging on what we would call point zero here, and the other levels are suspended from those. So this is the terrific discovery about orbs and consciousness and the creation of reality. It means that you and I have 6 other existences going right now. That we are existing in all those planes right now, except they've been lulled to sleep and they're dormant.
Mm-hmm.
So our job about awakening consciousness is to wake up those other realms of ourselves.
When you say frequencies, existence above us, you don't literally mean up and down. You mean vibrating at a higher rate, right?
Yes, I mean, obviously, whether you depict that up or down or sideways or inversely, it doesn't matter.
And
they're just higher frequencies.
And all of that is right here. I mean, there could be something right here in the chair with me, but it's vibrating at a different speed, and I don't see it, but that doesn't mean it's not here.
Absolutely. Couldn't have put it better.
Okay.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And I think, you know, this is why the hamburger universe is such a good image to illustrate that. We're always inclined to look up. We're always inclined to look out. Whereas, you know, the real truth is within.
Right.
And the understanding of time is so important for healing or for anything else. You know, the time is not linear like we have been assuming all of these centuries.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually parallel. And it's, you know, it's almost like, you know, the old cassette tapes. If I wanted to play track 6, say, on a cassette tape, I have to fast forward to the first 5 tracks before I reach track 6. If I want to play track 3, I've got to fast reverse. Whereas if I'm using a CD or a DVD, you know, I can flick instantly from one track to another. And that's the way time really is. It's not like the cassette where there's a before and an after. It's like more like the CD or the DVD. It's parallel and it's instantaneously accessible. So in other words, if I were able to use either an instrument or if I had developed my own consciousness in this way, by the way, anyone can see orbs with the naked eye, as I hope we'll go on to explain how.
Really? Tell me.
Yeah. Well, let me just finish this little bit first. But if we realize what's going on here, you know, that all those aspects of you and me, which are the aspects that Jesus was referring to when he said, you'll do all the wonders that I did and greater, all of these are right here. And if we had an instrument, you know, as you said, to reveal the existence, say, of someone who was dearly beloved of mine but has passed on, my mother, father, my husband, wife, my child, whatever, you know, you could pick them up. You could see them there. I mean, all of these dimensions are superimposed upon each other. They're not out in some distant place like Alpha Centauri or the Pleiades. They're all right here.
You know, I heard that, you know, do you know his name, Peter Moscow?
No.
Peter Moscow told me that he's a scientist somewhere, that the guy Faraday, who developed the television, I think that's his name, Faraday, that his nephew is living now, and he has the same passion about televisions and information transmissions, and that he's developed some kind of screen with some kind of special antenna, and it must be in wire shape form, because Peter said you can stretch it around a vicinity, a house, a room, a person, and an acreage, and then whatever this thing is, it's not out on the market yet. It's kind of still got some patent issues, but you could see the things in that area that were vibrating at a different speed on this screen.
Wow.
It's amazing. So the technology is there.
Oh, that's amazing. That's wonderful. No, I had not heard of that. But
yeah.
That's exactly consonant with what I'm saying.
Exactly. I mean, he said it was amazing that things would, you know, faces and things would flash onto this screen.
Mm.
Amazing. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead and tell what you
were
talking
about. We were talking about seeing orbs, you know, and you asked me to elaborate a little on that. Now, anyone can see orbs. I was quite amazed after about 2 years of doing orb photography every night, which I did. I did it at the night because I was in that mindset that time that believes the spirits have to do with nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
I now know, of course, that that's not so. You can take orb pictures, you know, superbly well in broad daylight at high noon as long as you've got a dark background. But anyway, I was taking these pictures, let me say, religiously, unquote, every night. And after about 2 years of doing this, lo and behold, to my enormous surprise one day, I began to see orbs with my naked eye. Now, you know, a lot of people think, you know, if you can see orbs with the naked eye, you're a guru or a saint or an avatar or somebody specially favored by God. None of the above. What happens is this, and I've explained it in more in the DVD, the new DVD, Orbs Clues to a More Exciting Universe, than in the book itself. But here's what happens. When I look at some scene, my eye is taking in a huge amount of information. Now, there's no way the brain could cope with all of that. So the brain filters out 90% or more of what comes in through the eye. And the stuff that the brain lets through is practical stuff, you know, like taking the children to daycare, doing the laundry,
right,
cooking the meals, etc. And orbs obviously don't fit into that practical mode of things at all. But if you keep signaling to your brain that these are important to me, and, you know, I think the photography of orbs on a daily basis is an excellent way of doing that, what will happen eventually, in my case it was 2 years, it could be faster or slower, what will happen is the brain will stop censoring the orb pictures, and you will see orbs with your naked eye without the benefit of the digital camera or any camera.
That's amazing.
It's really. I mean, I know people now who have followed that. Obviously, I've been talking a lot about this, and I know people who have actually followed that advice, and they're seeing orbs with their naked eye to their great delight. And of course, children are superb at this because, you know, they haven't the hard wiring in the brain that we have, and they're much more open and receptive. And they can. I know a lot of children who have always seen orbs.
You know, I was a huge skeptic of orbs before I read your book. And after I read the book, I have a digital camera, and I laid in the bed at night and just snapped in my room. Snap, 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 constantly, you know. And I was amazed that at first there were no orbs there. And then before I knew it, there would be 10 or 20
Wow.
or 1,000. So I believe you now.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that it really is.
Well, I was on a TV, breakfast TV program down in Portland, Oregon recently, and there were two interviewers. This is at 9 in the morning, and they said to me, you know, we're very skeptical. And I said, the only difference between you and me is that I started out more skeptical than both of you combined. But I said, I know this phenomenon is real, and there's, you know, lots of explanations, dust, particle, pollens, particles, rain, etc. Klaus and I have gone into this in all sorts of detail, and we're quite satisfied that while there are such, you know, false orb pictures, that the phenomenon is absolutely genuine. And I've always said something that makes a lot of people laugh. I said there are two things that I do not like to waste much time discussing. The first is the existence of orbs. Buy a $50 camera and go and take them yourself. You do not need me to convince you. This is not the exclusive prerogative of any guru or avatar or saint. Anyone can do this, even a child. And the second thing that I don't believe in wasting time discussing is reincarnation. Because when someone says to me, I don't believe in reincarnation, I say, well, that's probably exactly what you said the last time, too.
So what have you found out about intelligence within these orbs, especially, the, you know, of the different colors?
Yes.
I would imagine that the ones with a higher frequency color would have more intelligence.
No. All of these, you know, now I presume we're going to allow that every human being on this earth has intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on the Hertzian plane, which is the bottom of the seven-layered realm of the electromagnetic spectrum that you'll find portrayed in every high school physics book.
Let me add this. What about more awareness?
Well, the much broader awareness, absolutely. Every orb is on a level higher than you and I. So if we're intelligent, obviously orbs, it goes without saying, are intelligent. But this is a thing I never thought I probably would talk about on a public channel like this.
Why?
In October, November 2002, there was certain phenomena happening with the orbs I was photographing. They were appearing in a hexagonal form rather than a spherical form. Now, I know what causes that. It's to do with camera mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
But it was happening so often that I said, my goodness me, this can't be an accident. I wonder, are they trying to signal me? So, you know, I would have thought that if anyone thought that orbs were trying to communicate with them at that point, I would probably have dialed 911 and sent for the guys in the white coat
mm-hmm.
so that this person could get proper care. But anyway, I started off and I said, you know, let's say that this hexagonal form, which is presumably more difficult to do, because obviously it's got to manipulate the camera electronics some way to produce it. Let's say that represents the answer yes to a question. And the spherical shape, the ordinary shape, will represent the answer no. So I started out asking questions to which I already knew the answers just to test out. And lo and behold, to make a long story very short, I found out that they were trying to signal to me. So for 5 months on practically at every daily basis, I went out and for an hour or 2 hours, I posed these series of questions, asking for a yes or no answer. And I found I had to wait about 30 seconds after asking the question before the answer came. But an extraordinary series of communications resulted from about February to March or April of the following year.
Tell me some of the things you learned.
Well, I was mainly interested at that time, you know, in the way things were going in the world, and that, if you remember that date, it was before the Iraqi war.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all interested, you know, as to whether actually there was going to be a war in Iraq or not. And they told me, yes, there is going to be a war in Iraq. And initially, I'm synopsizing this very, very radically here. You understand that?
But, yes.
And then they said, you know, it will initially go well, and then after that it will start to fragment, and there's going to be lots of problems, and there's going to be a lot of resentment, you know, in this country here about it, and so on. There's going to be a lot of upset and disturbance, and we went on from current affairs to, you know, where the world was going. We're heading into difficult times, obviously.
Yeah.
I think everyone knows that. Nothing very radical about that. So, but basically, everything they told me, you know, up to the present and somewhat beyond our present time, has actually turned out more or less as they said.
What about the controversial topic of 2012?
Oh, well.
Now, I don't think, just so you understand where I'm coming from, I don't think the world's going to explode or anything. I think that, it's going to be kind of like the scales of justice energetically
mm-hmm.
in that, what if we don't straighten up the world, the mass consciousness by that time, it's going to tip and we may not come back and have to live in horrific times, you know, no water, improper food, more warring. So that's, I just want to know what you think or if you even asked that.
Well, I didn't ask about 2012 specifically, though by coincidence I viewed a DVD last night called The Horizon Project, or The Horizon Point, I can't remember what it was, which featured Dr. Brooks Agnew, a good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah, I know him.
Yes. Yeah. We're talking together down at the aesthetic conference at Trout Lake, Washington, the extraterrestrial contact conference next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they really did paint a horrifying scenario there of what we're facing against, nothing to do with, you know, human responsibility, so much as with cycles through which the cosmos goes and through which the Earth goes. And they were talking about the fact that undoubtedly now from discoveries in archaeology, it looks like that the Earth, you know, was quite advanced, say, technologically, several times in the past, at least that we have some indication of, and that all traces of it vanished. And that it's entirely possible, though no one wants to be a doomsday scenario prophet here, I certainly don't, and I'm sure you don't either, but it's entirely possible that we could be going through or heading towards another cycle of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I look, for instance, at the problems we're having in the breadbasket of the United States, even the last few weeks, you know, in the Midwest with all these floods, and I find out the soybean crop is down 10%, and the corn crop is down so much more, and the prices of food are escalating. Nobody wants to be a doomsday scenario prophet, but neither do we want to be grasshoppers, you know, that we dance and sing while the sun is out, and then, you know, if things get difficult, we're left defenseless. We need to be wise like ants.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we are going through tough times, for instance, if the price of bread, as it has doubled, the price of hay for livestock has doubled in the last year, I mean, these are straws in the wind. And if we want to bury our heads in the sand and ignore all the signs of what's going on, well, of course, that is our prerogative, that's our privilege. But I think it would be very unwise to ignore all the signs that we might be going into a difficult time in our history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we act not like a grasshopper, but like an ant, as my old teacher Ramta used to say, we'll be wise, we'll prepare for this. I mean, we're going to come through it. As you rightly said, the world is not going to end. But, you know, we could be going through tough times. We don't know what effect, for instance, these expected sun flares and so forth are going to have on our electronics. We don't know what will happen if the polar ice cap should melt, for instance. If anyone is interested in this topic, I would say keep your eyes on the polar ice caps. And that's your barometer. And if you see some dramatic activity going on there, if you see, for instance, that in the Arctic, in the Northern Hemisphere, that most, if not all, of the ice disappears in the next 2 years or so, I would regard that as a very grave sign.
Mm-hmm. What... can you tell me some more questions that you asked and got answers to?
Well, I was mostly interested in what these beings themselves were. I mean, I was interested in what was going to happen in the world and how it would affect us. But I also was asking, you know, where they came from, and the answer was that they did not come from anywhere, no place, in other words, that they were energy beings. And that this was, you know, a very respectable form of existence, more superior, in fact, than ours. So they didn't come from anywhere. And I said, are you interested in the people of this earth? And the answer was no. And I thought, you know, that this was a misfiring of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the question several times, and the answer was still no. And I began to wonder why this would be. And, you know, I said, do you love the people of this earth? And the answer was no, no, and no, and no. And then, of course, what eventually came out of this was that love, as we express it and understand it, is a very much a conditional thing. You know, I love you provided you do A, B, C, and D, and E. And if you do not, you know, fulfill those requirements that I have, I don't love you anymore. And what they meant was that they are not emotionally involved, which is basically a physical thing, that they're out of the bag of chemical reactions that all of us exhibit so often, because most of our emotions, as Ramta says, are just a bag of chemicals. There's nothing more to it than that. And the sooner we get out of the bag of chemicals, you know, the sooner we're going to emerge into being able to accomplish something worthwhile in terms of controlling our destiny.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that they were, you know, calm, cool, calculating, removed from, like, some of the alien stuff you see, you know, doing experiments on people. And it wasn't that at all. It's just that they were not emotionally involved with us and did not love us in that sense, but they were interested in what was going on, and they did respect that we were a sovereign race that had our own destiny and that we could not be interfered with against our will.
Mm-hmm. We've got about 20 minutes.
Oh, dear, where did all that time go?
I'm going to give you some choices and questions. You can tell me some more questions that you asked and what they replied. I want to know, do you think that thought creates? Do you think that God has emotion? Because what you just said, emotion is chemical, you know, it's serotonin, norepinephrine.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And what I think is God has agape, you know. Everything
yes.
is perfect.
Right.
He doesn't, you know, he just says, oh, that's a consequence of this, but doesn't have the emotion attached.
No, you're absolutely right.
So,
what was the first question again, Eva? There was just a little break in the line there.
Oh, I'm sorry. You could, some more questions that you ask and their responses. There's also one other thing I wanted to ask you.
No, you asked me a question right there, and I just missed the crucial word.
Oh, talk about some more questions you ask, and then talk about, do you think that thought creates?
Oh, yes, that was it.
Do you think that...
Yeah. Let's just focus on that, could we, for a minute?
Okay.
If that's okay with
yes.
you. I absolutely do believe. I was in the little movie, What the Bleep Do We Know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sequel, Down the Rabbit Hole.
Right.
And, of course, as you know, the basic premise of that movie is that if you observe reality, reality will obligingly take the shape in which you observe it. Now, of course, that's very blithe and very easy, because the way you observe reality, of course, is a highly technical matter. That's not just a matter of saying I'm observing reality, because, as I said earlier in the program, it is not the conscious mind that affects the quantum field. It's the superconscious. And the conscious mind, according to recent neuroscience, can process about 2,000 pieces of information per second. Now, by contrast, the superconscious mind is able to process about 400 million pieces per second. Which one would you like to control? So, the secret of manifesting, and, you know, my own publishers published The Secret, but I think the problem with The Secret was it conveyed that this process was really easy, you know. You just go out there and you say this and you say that.
Yeah.
And, of course, nothing happens, and then everyone is disappointed, and they say, oh, to heck with that stuff, you know?
I had the same problem with that movie.
Had you?
And I want to ask you this question, because it relates to that. Do you think we have complete free will? Because if we have complete free will, in other words, there's no energy that has any exertion over us at all, then you can say, Eva, remember last time something happened to our interview, remember?
That's right.
Then if we had complete free will, nothing would have happened.
Right.
So do we have free will to place intention, or do we have complete free will?
Well, I think, I mean, I do not subscribe to the view, and we could spend, you know, a week at this, that there's someone out there trying to control our free will.
I don't think that, but what I do think is that we live in a hologram.
Absolutely.
And that something created that hologram, and, you know, if God had, I don't think he has emotion because he doesn't have norepinephrine and serotonin and dopamine floating around.
Right.
So the only way that the energy of all there is can experience anything is if it incarnates into something, because that's the only way it's going to have any emotion to judge, oh, I like that or I don't like that.
Right.
You know, how does it feel to be big and fat and 15 and pregnant and have no husband? How does
right.
it feel to be married and be truly loved and have a wonderful child?
Mm-hmm.
The only way you know is if you do it.
Right.
So I don't think it's something manipulating us, but an experience.
I agree totally. I mean, if we regard, if we take that little image I used at the start of the seven-layered triad of reality, which Ramtha uses, for instance, and many others, too, have used it, you know, for millennia.
Mm-hmm.
God is the top of that, the zero point. And God has basically told us, as Ramtha has said so often, go and explore the unknown. And the exploring of the unknown is what you have so eloquently just described. We've got to go down through these six or seven planes, and we've got to incarnate in them, and we've got to explore their potentials. God has not judged us. All God wants us to do, and you notice I've never used he or she or it, God only wants us to explore the unknown of the potentials of the creation that God made. So, have we free will from God? Absolutely. Have we absolute free will in everything we do? We certainly do not, but do you know why? It's because we have enslaved ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Through our fears and apprehensions and the centuries of suppression and hostility and anger and fear and guilt, greed, you know, we're the ones that have affected our free will.
All right, we've got about 12 minutes, and what I want to talk about, you wrote on your website, I got it right here. You talked about, let me find this, just a second.
It must be heretical.
Well, you were talking about manifestation of your life.
Yes.
And let me get back here where you have your articles. Shoot, I'm sorry to waste even a second.
No, that's all right. You know, I write an article every month in that magazine that came out of What the Bleep Do We Know, the Bleeping Herald. And I do usually an expanded version on my own website, hamburgeruniverse.com. If anyone has our pictures or want any comments, you know, on our conversation tonight, please feel very welcome to email me at Hamburger Universe or your website or whatever. And I'll be glad to do the best I can.
Here it is. Poisoned prayer, the tragic effect of not reversing the law of cause and effect.
I see people, you have done your homework.
People do think, oh, I could manifest whatever I want, but you can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know,
not in an instant anyway.
Yeah. I think I used in that article the tragic example of a beautiful young lady that I knew in Ireland who was about, at this stage, 33 years old with a great husband and two beautiful daughters. And she had got breast cancer from which, unfortunately, she died about a year later. But she said to me, because I was a good friend of her family, she said, you know, I cannot just understand how I ever got breast cancer. Because my mother died of breast cancer when I was 8 years old. And I can tell you this, literally, every night since that time when my mother died, I have prayed to God morning and night that I would not get cancer. And I said to her, you know, over the course of a couple of hours, as gently as I could, I said, you know, what you need to realize is that it was almost impossible for you to escape getting cancer. Because if cancer is in your focus, morning, noon, and night over all those years, it doesn't matter what the motive is. It doesn't matter whether you're afraid of it, whether you're begging to be delivered of it or protected from it. It's in the focus of your frontal lobe. Therefore, you are affecting the quantum field, and you are going to create that. So what I'm saying is that this kind of prayer, we have never been warned about,
right,
as something that can bring the most horrible things into our lives. Because we have always been taught, oh, you know, you ask God, you beg God, you beseech, you implore, and all that. I call that the vocabulary of doom.
Yes.
Because Jesus said, when you pray for something, believe it is already yours, and it will be so. So if I want to be delivered from cancer, the last thing I should be putting in my focus is cancer, but wellness.
Yes. Tell me if this is what you mean. I told this story that, be careful what you pray, because consciousness doesn't know. If you don't like black horses, then don't say, I don't want a black horse, because consciousness doesn't know what I don't want is. It just knows black horse, so you manifest a black horse you don't want.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
That is exactly what I mean. And I said earlier in the program tonight that the aspect of you and I that affects the quantum field and that then cascades down into our reality, the aspect of you and I that does that is not conscious mind, it's the superconscious mind. And the superconscious mind has no judgment and it has no time. All it sees is what are you putting into its focus. So if you're putting in a fear of black horses and you want to be delivered from it, you are saying to the conscious mind, you know, black horse.
Black horse. Anything else? You can give your website again quickly. We've got just a couple minutes. Anything else you want to say?
Yeah, www.hamburgeruniverse, just the ordinary words, hamburgeruniverse.com. And there's a contact there if you want to contact me there, if you want to contact me through Eva's website or whatever, with orb pictures or anything else. My book is The Orb Project, The Orb Project by Simon Schuster, Beyond Words. My Jesus DVD, How Jesus Became a Christ, talks about the hidden years in Egypt, India, and Tibet. It always puzzled me why, from the time he was 12 until he was 30. We hear nothing about him. And we're told by tradition, you know, that he went down to Nazareth and worked in the carpenter shop with Joseph. Well, mm-hmm. you know, if someone comes out of an 18-year carpentership apprentice and is able to heal the sick, walk on water, and raise the dead, we should all take up woodwork right away.
Right.
But I think much more interesting things were happening in Egypt, India, and Tibet, and that's the focus of that DVD. So that Jesus didn't come to suffer and die for our sins. He came to lead us on the glorious road of power and accomplishment, so that we also could do the things that he did. We don't need to suffer. We don't need to be prey to disease. We don't need to be, you know, powerless people who just incessantly age. We can reverse all of that. And that is our birthright, not something extraordinary.
Well, this has been, I'm going to call you when we hang up and reschedule you to come back, if you don't mind.
I'd be privileged. Thank you.
I have a million more questions. You still got 7 minutes if you want to say anything else.
Well, the other DVD, I produced three DVDs. One is the recent one on orbs, where I'm moving out from where the book was, which has all of the basic information that we could assimilate about what the phenomenon of orbs is. Orbs are basically what you and I are without the physical body. So if I were unfortunate enough to step out in front of a bus tonight and got killed, I would be an orb straight away. And I have been an orb, obviously, as everyone has, many times over. So orbs are basically the part of you and I that are not in physical bodies right now. And, you know, there are some orbs that have never been in a physical body. There are some orbs that have no intention of ever being in any physical body of any kind, and there are orbs who have been in physical bodies in subhuman forms, in animal forms, or in others, maybe superhuman forms, in other parts of this created universe. So there's a variety in there. But
so does we know that everything that is in physical reality has consciousness attached because it's got, you know, the field in it.
Yes.
So would everything have an orb? Or
yes.
have that force within them?
I'm not sure what form, say, the subhuman things do. Do animals have orbs? Absolutely, yes, they do. When the orb is incarnated in a physical form, such as, say, my body or a horse, and the orb DVD, my orb DVD, Clues to a More Exciting Universe, I tell the story of a very, very treasured family pet we had here in the house where I'm speaking from, a horse who was 27 years old. And the night that she died, we had truly extraordinary phenomena.
Amazing.
So, that tells me a lot about the animal world. So, yes, certainly all human forms, all superhuman forms, all animal forms have orbs because they're all hanging in that chain of command from point zero.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes. What about the dark orbs you saw?
I never saw one.
There's a picture and one over a church.
I think that's Klaus's.
Oh, is it? Do you have a comment on that?
No, I don't think there are dark forces here. I mean, there are people who have passed over who are completely materialistic, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
in their human life. And a lot of those unfortunate beings, you know, they don't know that there's anything after death. They have only believed in the physical. And usually when those people die, they stay attached to the physical. And you can find them trying to live off people who are still alive. You can photograph them. I have the photographs. I mean, you go to a bar, go to a nightclub. I'm not condemning bars and nightclubs by any means. Go to, say, people who are taking drugs, which I've fortunately never done. But any place where human consciousness and free will is lowered,
mm-hmm.
those earthbound beings who are not orbs, because they haven't gone to the light and progressed to what the orb is, you'll find them around that place trying to live vicariously through human beings still.
Exactly.
They might be dark forces, but in terms of strict orbs, I have never found any dark force, and I don't think anyone should have the slightest fear, good, bad, or indifferent, that they are dabbling in the occult in the sense of something harmful or satanic or trying to lead you astray by indulging in the photography of orbs. I think it's going to be a message of profound hope and liberation to know that we do not cease when we lose the physical body. Indeed, that we do not necessarily need to lose the physical body. We could live for many, 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 many decades more than we are doing right now. And possibly it's feasible to protract that indefinitely. That is certainly a reality. We know we have an immortal gene. Mm-hmm. It's just our own victimization and negativity has caused us to die after a relatively short lifespan. I mean, I think the phenomenon of orbs is opening up tremendous vistas of hope, encouragement, and joy for all who are living on this earth, especially in the difficult times we're facing. Mm-hmm. This is one of the best ways to prepare ourselves so that we can come through it proudly.
Yes. Well, I have to say I have so enjoyed this interview with you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Eva.
And
I did too.
I really want to have you back because I know, I mean, you've kept me on the edge of my seat, and not very many people do that.
That's because you're on to something wonderful.
Well, thank you, and
so
agape.
I'm so glad you're doing the work you've been doing consistently for so long. We need people like you.
Well, we need you too.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night, and good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.